From climate change to energy and environmental matters, you're listening to Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Well, thank you for joining us today. I'm excited. We have a very exciting show. Dr. Robert Malone, one of the inventors of the mRNA vaccine, will be joining the program in about 25 minutes. So you need to stay tuned for that. We are going to have an in-depth discussion on the World Health Organization, the pandemic treaty, public health tyranny, Bill Gates, vaccine mandates, the Great Reset, you name it. And of course, we will get into all that. And one of the issues is going to be Bill Gates is at it again. Bill Gates is funding, and I'm not making this up, a cow vaccine. Yes, you heard that right. They're using the word vaccine. Bill Gates funds cow vaccine to reduce livestock farts full of methane emissions to stop climate change. This is not out of The Onion. This is not out of Babylon Bee. This is out of mainstream media sources, Axios reporting this. $26 million raised to stop cow farts and burps. And this is an article by Ben Jimin and Dan Primack. A Boston developer of a vaccine named Arcavio Bio is set to reduce livestock methane emissions, raised $26.5 million in a venture capital funding led by an investment fund founded by Bill Gates. Hearing about cow farts or burps has become a political punchline, but they're estimated to create more than 5% of global greenhouse gases. You got that? You can't eat meat because of global greenhouse gases, 5%. Vaccines could be a relatively low-cost solution, particularly as food demand increases. And they go on. So this is what they're trying to do now. Inject cows with some Bill Gates-funded vaccine that I'm sure he invests $26 million. He's going to make $26 billion. That's the way Bill Gates' philanthrocapitalism works. I'm a philanthropist. I'm a billionaire. I give away my money for good. How come the more money you give away, the wealthier and more power you get? That doesn't go with philanthropy. That's why RFK Jr. nailed it when he said Bill Gates practices philanthrocapitalism, where basically the more money he gives away, the wealthier he gets. All right. One other breaking news development, and it's working. We've been on this show. We had Peter Sweden on last week. We've had multiple European analysts on, Andrew Montford. We've had UK members of parliament on just recently. Polish farmers march against green poison EU climate rules. They had signs, placards, thousands of them out there, down with the Green Deal, down with the European Union. They are spot on. If I was in Poland, Poland is a fascinating country. I've been there three times over decades. And here's the thing about Poland. They're a country who literally suffered under Nazi occupation for years, brutalized, concentration camps, raping of women, pillaging, just destroyed under the iron fist of Adolf Hitler. Then the Allies win World War II. We beat the Axis powers. Germany goes down in defeat. So Polish people probably for a brief moment, maybe not, maybe, thought we're going to be liberated from Nazi Germany. We're going to be free. No. Stalin's Russia came in and descended the Iron Curtain for another 40 years. Actually more than 40 years, about 45 years, 44 years, on Poland. Poland had to endure long-term Soviet occupation, puppet governments, satellite governments under the Eastern Bloc communism. Finally, they break free. 1989, 1990, the whole thing started a decade early. Lech Walesa, the Polish union leader. I've been to the Polish coal mines. I've met with the Polish union workers. And then what happens? The Cold War ends, and then you have the Greenies reorganize with the energy lost from propping up the Soviet Union and supporting it ideologically. Communism wasn't done correctly, and oh, they had many good qualities. And now Poland is facing the EU regulations, horrible, and they're also facing the new green regulations. Their country, their economy, their way of life is just as threatened, at least economically, under the green wall. Obviously not as severe as communism and Nazism, but the same impulse of totalitarian control, centralized planning is coming at them with this green net zero sustainable development agenda. Poles know tyranny. And that's why the Polish protesters are out there, Polish farmers, down with the European Union, down with the Green Deal. That is what we are talking about. All right. So, and remember, these farmers all throughout Europe spraying manure on the Brussels headquarters, which I've spoken at and done a presentation, premiered my movie in Europe at the EU in 2000. Boy, I had to think back. My movie came out 2016, Climate Hustle. I think I was there the following, could have been the same year. It could have been fall of 2016 that I did it. I can't, I think that's right. So it was about 6 months after the US premiere. I went to the EU, and man, it is a monument to bureaucracy in Brussels there, that whole thing. Anyway, they were able to halt the Green New Deal because of the farmers, just like the angry parents. So kudos to the farmers, and kudos especially to the Polish farmers and the Polish plight, because the last thing they need is a new tyranny. And I've interviewed Václav Klaus in Czech Republic at his presidential mansion, presidential library, and the former president of Czech Republic who grew up under communism. And he said it's the same impulse, and even likened the same impulse to COVID tyranny and during the lockdowns, which is in my book, The Great Reset. You can read about what Václav Klaus said there. Okay, I don't want to waste too much time because we have Robert Malone joining us here. I have to go back to Kristi Noem, a couple updates here. It's just, she's toast. Now, it's the kind of thing she could come back, but more as a pop culture entertainment figure if she's self-deprecating. But I think in serious politics, I don't see how you could take her seriously again, ever. She's kaput. This is just a replay. I don't think I actually showed this clip before. Her on CNN, just with the worst possible answers, evading the question, giving gibberish. But she, again, I give her credit. She does it with such confidence, almost poise. You almost have to scratch your head and be like, what am I seeing here? Anyway, watch her evade basic questions. This is a flashback from about 10 days ago, 12 days ago. But then I'm going to lead into it. I actually have the audio of her reading about killing her dog and then the reaction. So I have two pretty neat audio clips coming up. Clip one, Kristi Noem on CNN, basically ending her political career.
You write about North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. You've been questioned several times on this in the last couple of days because you've issued a retraction. You said that it shouldn't have been in the book, this passage, that it was a mistake. Why shouldn't it have been in the book? Is it untrue?
No, what I said is that when this was pointed out, that we made an adjustment to what the content was in the book. I've met many world leaders around the world. I've been to the DMZ. I've been traveling for years and years talking to world leaders. Just that name should not be in the book, and I'm not going to discuss those personal meetings.
That's the end. I mean, it's such an effing bizarre answer. You had this in the book, you met with them, and then you took it out. Did you or did you not meet with them? Oh, I met with many world leaders. Well, did you not meet with them? Well, I don't talk about my meetings with world leaders. But what the? You just talked. Bye-bye. Okay, Kristi Noem. This is her reading the actual puppy story. So I just want you to hear this about her killing the puppy and pay attention to one thing. And then I'm going to go, I have the clip, another clip of her reading it, or actually another report on it, but just listen, watch this first one and notice one thing as you're listening to it. The anger. She didn't kill this puppy after reason, thought, consultation, weighing the pros and cons, giving it time. She did it out of sheer rage and anger. Just listen to this anger and then how she almost uses the killing of the puppy as some kind of weird emotional therapy for herself. Clip two.
So we finally have, because the book hit today, including the audio version, Kristi Noem, in her own words, describing the murder of the 14-month-old puppy Cricket. We've condensed it into a 2-minute clip. Here it is.
Cricket was a wire hair pointer, about 14 months old, and she had come to us from a home that had struggled with her aggressive personality. I was sure that she'd learn a lot going out with our older dogs that day. I was wrong. Within an hour of walking the first field, Cricket had blown past the group, gotten too far ahead. She'd flushed up birds that were out of range. She was out of her mind with excitement, chasing all those birds and having the time of her life. The only problem was no, there was no hunters nearby to shoot the birds that she was scaring up. I called her back to no avail. I hit her electronic collar to give her a quick tone to remind her to listen. I then hit the button to give her a warning vibration that told her to come back to me now. No response. The hunt was ruined, and I was livid. Some neighbors who recently purchased a puppy from us asked me to stop and to check on their pup on the way home. Suddenly, out of the corner of my eye, I caught a glimpse of Cricket launching herself out of the back end of the pickup and racing across the yard. All three of us chased Cricket around in circles, flailing after her while she systematically grabbed one chicken at a time, crunching it to death with one bite, and then dropping it to attack another. She was like a trained assassin. Eventually, I got my hand on her collar and she whipped around to bite me. There were bloodied bodies and feathers everywhere. When I got back into my truck, Cricket was sitting in the passenger seat, looking like she had just won the lottery, the picture of pure joy. I hated that dog. As I drove home, I realized that I had no choice. Cricket was untrainable, and after trying to bite me, dangerous to anybody that she came in contact with. A dog who bites is dangerous and unpredictable. Are you listening, Joe Biden? She was less than worthless to us as a hunting dog. At that moment, I realized I had to put her down. As I pulled into the driveway, I decided I had to deal with this problem myself. This was my dog, and it was my responsibility. And I would not ask somebody else to clean up my mess. I stopped the truck in the middle of the yard. I got out my gun, grabbed Cricket's leash, and I let her out into the pasture and down into the gravel pit. It was not a pleasant job, but it had to be done.
Okay, now we know all the facts according to Kristi Noem. I still think it's fine for an owner to shoot their own dog as opposed to taking it to the vet or having someone come to your house and injecting it lethally. I don't have any problem with that. No reason that's an issue. But I do have many problems with what she said. First of all, the dog was living it up. Pure bliss, sitting next to her in the truck, happiest day of his life. She said he was on top of, just as happy as any dog could ever be. And I know that. I mean, currently I have five dogs in my house because our dog had puppies and we're trying to adopt some out. You know, our 3-year-old mixed rescue dog killed a squirrel in the backyard, was growling at all the other dogs, carried that squirrel all throughout the yard, brought it in the house, was running through like a trophy. I tried to get it out of his mouth and he sort of didn't really try to bite me, but was sort of growling and didn't want to give it up. This was his prize. That's perfectly normal dog behavior. That was not an aggressive human biting dog that she described. Holding a prize thing and you're reaching for it and the dog is a puppy or 14 months old, doesn't respect you, not trained by you, all your little gadgets and collars and buzzing, it doesn't have any hierarchy there. So that's absolutely perfectly normal dog behavior, not the behavior of a dog, aggressive, dangerous dog that she's claiming. More importantly, during that whole interlude there, she's talking about how livid she was, how angry she was. She knew what had to be done. The dog was worthless. I hated that dog, is what she said. And she goes and kills it. Almost irrationally angry, momentary, tells you a lot about her character. Number two, this is clip three. This now is a report about what the uncle called her up. And I believe this is her own voice. If not, it's a report about the book. But this is her with the people around her who are like, wait a minute, are you okay? It's a little, you sound out of control today. This was even out of character. It's not her normal character, apparently, to lose her temper. And I think she just had a blinding rage incident and probably regretted it, but she couldn't actually regret it because she did it. So she doubled down and, clip three, you can hear the reaction to people close to her after she killed the dog.
My uncle, who was the general contractor building our house, called me and he said, "What got into you today?" "Nothing," I responded. "Why?"
He said, well, the guy said you came barreling into the yard with your truck. You slammed the door, took a gun and a dog over the hill out of sight. They heard one shot. You came back without the dog. Then you grabbed the goat and headed back up over the hill. Then they heard another shot.
Her uncle, what the hell has gotten into you today? And all the other workers and witnesses reported it to the uncle. This was kind of strange behavior for like a mass killing. She's clearly livid. She hated the dog. She was angry. And there was every chance of giving this dog a chance. And it was killing freaking chickens. Any of my five dogs would kill a chicken if they were out there and saw it. I mean, you know, that's just a dog's instinct. And this is a form of, what's the word I'm looking for? Self-justification or justifying bad behavior. She's reporting this, kind of like throwing it all in, but I stand by, I'm an executive. I make the tough decisions. You didn't make the tough shit. You reacted angrily, emotionally. You saw red. You hated the dog. You had rage. You despised it. These are all your own words. And then you decided on the spot to kill it. Without any, and then all the people around you, including your uncle, thought the behavior was bizarre. And then you report on that to show what an outlier, tough figure you are. Sorry, I don't think that dog deserved to die by any stretch of the imagination. Any from that, from her own accounting. Now, I don't know, someone could come up with evidence that the dog bit people from here to every other county in South Dakota. I don't have that information. I'm just basing it on what she's saying. She did not make the case for killing that dog at all. Buck Sexton, who took over partially along with Dan Bongino, took over the old Rush Limbaugh network. He's a talk show host, former intelligence official. He has investigated Kristi Noem for years and thinks she's a fraud. Let's hear what Buck Sexton has to say on the Megyn Kelly Show, clip 4.
She's a phony, she's a poser, and she won't be honest about her own shortcomings, even when she's caught red-handed. That exchange with Jesse Waters, I don't have conversations about my conversations with world leaders. No one's asking you about substance. We're asking you, did you meet with him or didn't you? You're the one who brought it up, ma'am. You put it in your book. Did it happen or didn't it? And by the way, when you then claim when it was brought to my, who brought it to your attention? When? Why did you read the audiobook? When you read out loud, I met with Kim Jong-un and I stared him down. Did it occur to you that you were telling a lie? Because most of us would have a very clear memory if we had met with the leader of North Korea. It's kind of a big deal. Did you correct it then? Were you embarrassed? Did you go back through tooth and comb over your entire ghost-written memoir to make sure there were no other errors? Because you also appear to have lied about a meeting with Emmanuel Macron. How many lies are there in this book? And why should we believe you on anything, especially now your revisionist history about why you really shot your puppy, which she's now claiming the dog was basically a serial killer and not her?
It was a 14-month-old dog of a breed that I'm familiar with and have dealt with in the past. The notion that that kind of a dog is a threat to people, she's lying. And for anyone who's like, well, why are we spending time on this? She was the number one VP candidate, according to the betting markets.
Was Kristi Noem. She was the number one candidate. Now she's, of course, plummeted. All right. Last clip. This is the ghostwriter sharing his insight onto how the ghostwriting for a politician goes. And apparently they didn't follow the basic rules of ghostwriting because this book is a dumpster fire. Clip 5.
I prefer to spend 3 months talking to authors to make sure I get every detail right, especially if they're a high profile figure.
Lysak has paid close attention to the saga and the turmoil surrounding the launch and the sale of Kristi Noem's book, No Going Back, particularly her references to killing her dog and meeting North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. He says oftentimes high-profile subjects don't give the ghostwriter enough of their time, and this can lead to problems.
Celebrity memoirs, they're fan fiction. You take a couple of details and then expand it. Now, when I have to do that as a ghostwriter, what do I do? I send it to the author and say, how is this? Are there details here that are inaccurate? This is why I require more time from authors. Like, I need you to read this stuff first before it goes to the publisher, before it goes out there.
There are two specific mentions of meeting Kim Jong-un and talking about him, and a specific memory. I'm sure he underestimated me, having no clue about my experience staring down little tyrants. Did you tell your ghostwriter
to write that?
I've specifically have worked on policy for over 30 years. And over that time, I have traveled around the world and I have met with leaders around the world. And that anecdote, I've asked them to change the content and it will be removed.
It's a simple question. Did you or did you not meet with Kim Jong-un?
That's the answer that I have for you.
According to Lysak, while the intent may have been, in his words, on brand for Noam, the actual stories about Kim Jong-un and cricket did more harm than good.
And that's the understatement of the year. So I just love that. That's the story. That's the answer I have for you. Kind of like, I don't know. She'd been better off just saying, I declined to answer that question next. But or, you know, anyway, I don't want to go through anymore. I think I'm done with Kristi Noem now, unless there's something humorous. No more serious stuff on her. I think she's toast, but I would be happy to report humorous stuff as follow-ups in the future here. Okay, we take a break. When we come back, Dr. Robert Malone, who has a Substack, he's an internationally recognized scientist, physician, author, political commentator, the original inventor of the mRNA vaccination and DNA vaccination as technology platforms. He will be joining Unleashed on TNT. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after these messages with Dr. Robert Malone.
TNT's Dirk Pohlman.
So this is essential. We have now the insurance company saying it's a state actor that did it. So it's an act of war. It's not an act of terrorism. So we don't pay. And now we'll see what is officially coming up. I can tell you that this, what we just talked about, was not mentioned in the German mainstream media. This is something that was completely cast aside. We didn't hear about it.
The insurance policy seems, as you said correctly, seems to cover terrorism but not war. So compensation for the plaintiff would only be possible if the attack were considered an act of terrorism but not an act of war. However, this is important, however, even if the insurance covers only terrorism, a distinction has to be made between when a state is involved and when there's no state involvement.
The Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk, TNT.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT radio listeners rely on TNT radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
If you're still wearing a cloth or surgical mask around in public, you're guilty of spreading COVID misinformation. It really is that simple. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, joining the program, Dr. Robert Malone, internationally recognized scientist, physician, author, political commentator, original inventor of the mRNA vaccination. He has a Substack. You need to check out Robert Malone at Substack, RWM Malone, MD at Substack. Thank you for joining the program today, Dr. Malone.
Thanks for having me here, Mark.
Well, I appreciate everything you've done and speaking out, standing up. I featured you in my book, The Great Reset, Global Elites and the Permanent Lockdown. And I've been following you closely as you've been the one of the key voices in speaking out against what I call public health tyranny. So let's start by going back in time a little bit. How did you get involved in mRNA technology? And this is might be an interesting question for you. What was your view, say, of Anthony Fauci 10 years ago, 15 years ago? What was your view of public health in general and pandemic preparedness? Has that evolved over the years? Or did you generally think we had a working system of people who thought what was best for the country? Or did you have a sense that they were already captured by big pharma and doing the bidding, essentially, of the billionaire class? Tell us how you evolved and about some of your past research on mRNA technology in particular.
So how did I get involved in mRNA technology? I invented it. I was the original person working on it in 1987. There were many people working on RNA before and after me. As a basic biological molecule, there's a whole domain in science that's often referred to as the RNA world. But I was the one that basically ran into a cascade of discoveries that led to my realizing that this could be used for gene therapy purposes. And the easiest gene therapy application was for vaccines. So that's the short version of that. We can go on for an hour on that one. Then in terms of my involvement in public health, and let's call it biodefense, because that's how it's really structured within the government, this sector that we're really talking about, commercial sector. I got involved in this right after the anthrax attacks. Company that I had set up and we'd incorporated that eventually got merged with an American company called Inovio. The investors pulled back when the planes hit the towers and left me high and dry. And so casting about for a new job, I was employed by a company called Dynport Vaccine Company, which had just received what's called the Prime Systems contract for all biodefense-related product advanced development for the Department of Defense, which is where most of the action was back then, around the time of the anthrax attacks. Subsequently, Tony Fauci kind of swooped in and took over a lot of the DOD budget and mission on that space, and that's when he got his huge salary bonus and the big plus up in power that happened at the NIAID. Just, that's for historical reference.
Yeah, that would be 2002, correct?
I've always been fairly cynical about this. Yeah, about around that 01, 02. That was when Cheney really launched the whole biodefense initiative in a big way as a civilian project. It gave us BARDA and the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness Response, which is three down from the president, and all of that infrastructure. There was infrastructure before that, but nothing of this scale, and particularly the scale in the civilian sector. It was all defense. In terms of Tony, I've watched Tony my entire career. I kind of cut my teeth on HIV. Back then it was called LAV. My mentor at UC Davis actually went to visit Luc Montagnier with Bob Gallo in the earliest phases of the AIDS outbreak. UC Davis is just up the road from San Francisco. I'll never forget Murray Gardner literally dancing down the hall, returning from his flight from Paris, saying, "I've got the virus that causes AIDS in my pocket." Back then, there was no customs restrictions or anything. And so these virologists can bring stuff back and forth. Fast forward to the present, that same UC Davis program that grew out of that was intimately involved in the Wuhan Institute of Virology and EcoHealth Alliance projects. That's rarely discussed. Usually the focus is on EcoHealth. So that's really where I learned my trade in terms of the basics, fundamentals of virology and molecular biology, was in that laboratory of pathology at UC Davis. And actually a big award that I got, contract award with the Navy, funded the development of the Center for Research, where the gain of function related work was being done in cooperation with Wuhan. So I've kind of been at the fringes of this sector most of my professional life, and sometimes more intimately involved, sometimes less so. I'm seen as a immunology and virology and molecular biology specialist. And in particular, I'm skilled at writing large proposals for clients. For various reasons, I rarely had my own proposals funded, was very good at getting money for other people for their programs. And I've won literally billions of dollars. I'm also trained in regulatory affairs, clinical research, project management, kind of the whole toolkit from discovery bench research through FDA and licensure. I've met with FDA over various products many times. I've written many INDs and clinical protocols. So that's kind of my stock in trade for my consulting business that I ran for decades. But I'm also highly trained in bioethics. And it was the bioethics here that really triggered me. What was being done was a clear, gross breach of informed consent and all of the norms, not just the regulatory affairs norms that I've been trained on for years, but also the norms in terms of bioethics. And it was really my writing perhaps the first essay objecting to the bioethics of what was going on that led down this cascade of events that resulted in me having the prominence that's kind of happened and becoming a significant voice in opposition to what's happened during the COVID crisis.
I want to get to the COVID crisis as well, but I want to go back for a moment. I followed the work of an investigative journalist named Michael Fumento back in the 90s, who wrote a book, Science Under Siege. He also wrote a book about the myth of heterosexual AIDS, very critical of Anthony Fauci at the time. It seemed Fauci followed the same playbook during those days of HIV.
I would say that
they suppressed treatment and
Fauci, Fauci piloted that playbook during HIV. It's been fascinating. So Fauci has always kind of been in the background throughout my entire career. And he controls the money and he sets the agenda. And he is always been untouchable. He can get away with doing stuff that if I was to do it, I would be debarred. And that's been the case his entire career. He's just bulletproof. He gets away with all kinds of stuff that normal researchers, clinical researchers would not be able to sustain. Would destroy their careers, all kinds of transgressions, breaking the blind, premature disclosure results, all wrapped around, in most cases, advancing his interests and those of his agency in a variety of different ways. He plays Congress like a fiddle and really understands it. One of the things, just it's hard for people that are outside to wrap their arms around what Fauci represents, the true depth of the manipulation and corruption. He is a master at basically a master bureaucrat scientist. He is extremely adept at manipulating Congress, directing funds to congressional districts. He pork barrel as a concept hardly scratches the surface of Tony Fauci's career. He's just a master. And as I say, bulletproof, nothing he does ever blows back on him. One of the things when I was writing our book, Lies My Government Told Me in the Better Future Coming, I dove into, because I know how to work the search engines associated with NIH, and by the way, they've changed the accessibility of a lot of those, but I was able to dive in and document that he has something like 60 to 70 full-time employees working in public relations just for the NIAID. I'm not talking about all of NIH. I'm talking about just him and his division has a number of the full-time employees in their basically press office exceeds the newsrooms of most major newspapers.
Wow.
And his congressional liaisons, he has like about 10 congressional liaisons. So the news staff, PR people are something in the range of 8 to 10 times as many people as he has as congressional liaisons.
In 2001, 2002, when Dick Cheney made him sort of the civil engineer and gave him the big
bonus.
Big salary bonus and also the power bonus, and gave him sort of that national security, you know, backing. Do you think was it a different Anthony Fauci that occurred after that, put a one on steroids? In other words, did that affect him, you think, made him even more megalomaniac and more powerful? Because it seems like he was bad before that, but then he got bad on steroids after he had that extra power and money.
Well, and he became extremely adept at the, I'll just say lying, but lying doesn't even get at it. The skill set that is often mastered by members of the intelligence community in terms of manipulating individuals and language and turn that on the public and on media and on the Congress. The man, you know, in a sense, you have to step back and acknowledge that he became a master of DC. He became one of the most adroit, you know, these days it's trendy to use the term deep state, one of the most adroit actors in that space that perhaps the United States has seen, certainly in the 20th century.
Yeah, he has. Now, let's fast forward then. You have March of 2020. Well, actually, you have January of 2020. Let's start there. It's not all about Fauci, but Anthony Fauci did give an interview, I think it was late January, early February of 2020, where he said, do you see what they're doing in China? Can you imagine San Francisco or New York shutting down like that? We would never do that. Yet we did. The World Health Organization sent a sham investigative committee to China, and literally the words verbatim were, if you want to stop this virus, copy China. That's what their message to the world was, the World Health Organization. And then we all ended up copying China. So how did, as a public health expert, as someone who's been in this for decades, how shocked were you when World Health and even the Trump administration, which was supposed to be, you know, the pro-freedom conservative administration, went along with this? We now know Deborah Birx and Anthony Fauci duped Donald Trump into that, you know, 10 days to flatten the curve.
And just as a small nuance, but don't forget that Birx is a Fauci postdoc.
Okay.
This is George Carlin's big club, and you're not in it.
You're not in it.
That was revealed even more by an email that came out during the Daszak testimony that showed that Peter Hotez was on the same email thread as Fauci's one of Fauci's key lieutenants, as they were conspiring to avoid testimony for the lieutenant on the Hill before the Fauci testimony, because of course what the committee's trying to do is akin to a RICO investigation, where they get the little fish to cop on things and then use that to catch the big fish, which is what they did with Barrick and Daszak. So like I said, it is absolutely a club. And Hotez has been kind of a heir apparent in waiting for at least a decade now. I think he's a little disappointed, I suspect, with the outcome of how things have played out. But this is a cabal that successfully manipulates congressional appropriations and weaponizes fear, involving fear of infectious disease, to control decision-making about allocations on the Hill, and to manipulate the public, to manipulate the industry. I just did a hit with another academic yesterday, and we talked about the whole biodefense industrial complex and how that works. And for the small or mid-sized biotech that has managed to get publicly traded, so they're listed on the boards, this fear porn hype cycle is very effectively played using shelf offerings and then momentum traders, and then feeding your stock into a boom driven by this fear and hype, and making statements about how you've got the technology to solve the problem. And it doesn't even matter if you ever come up with a solution. The bubble pops almost inevitably, just like a monkeypox or leprosy in Florida, or you know, whatever the latest thing is. And the bubble pops. Well, you haven't built the thing that you said you were going to build. And so the momentum traders jump off, your stock plummets. Typically, you go below delisting threshold. Then you do a reverse split and you get to keep all the money to pay your $900,000 a year salary for the next decade. That's the ecosystem. It is intensely corrupt. And that doesn't even touch the whole issue of the stockpile contracts.
You know, there was a audio clip of a video clip of Anthony Fauci, maybe 2016-17, lamenting that mRNA vaccines would take so many years of the approval process and how long it's going to take and how it's just he was wishing for something to happen. So which brings me to my next question. Do you put much credence in these pandemic planning sessions that, say, Rockefeller hosted 2010, which talked about lockdowns, mask mandates, or that the World Health Organization, or actually World Economic Forum, John Hopkins did one in 2018?
So, they have at least three of them. Gates funded that agenda. Yes. 20. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So those literally, so people look at this maybe a little too conspiratorial. They think they were just I look at it sort of like a gun control advocate waiting for a school shooting to introduce legislation. They were planning, waiting for sort of the next virus scare in order to make this agenda happen. Or do you think it's even more sinister than that?
All these planning. Event 201 is very suspicious in terms of the timing. And
that was
a
year before, right? 2018, is that right? I think, yeah.
No. It was third quarter of 2019.
Third quarter, that's right. So, okay, fall of, yeah.
Right? Okay, so within a month and a half to 2 months of when the initial...
start hearing about a virus.
I'll say it neutrally, transmission of Wuhan 1 happened in Wuhan in close geographic proximity to the Wuhan Institute of Virology and happened to have the specific sequence that was predicted by a proposal submitted by EcoHealth Alliance a year and a half before. So draw your own straight line through those data points. At one level, thank God there's pandemic planning war games, right? We wouldn't want our bureaucracy and world leaders to not engage in war game planning for threat scenarios. That seems it's perfectly reasonable. But like a lot of things, perfectly reasonable, well-justified bureaucratic initiatives are often over time converted and weaponized into something else. It happens again and again and again, particularly if intelligence community is involved. And the intelligence community is all over this sector. Moderna exists because of a BARDA proposal, a BARDA program, funding program. Moderna is capitalized in part by InQtel. Okay, so the IC is deeply embedded in this tech and what was done here. Event 201 is just too prescient. I think that it's absolutely the case that the potential for coronaviruses or SARS-like viruses to be weaponized has been recognized for a long time. There are multiple peer-reviewed papers discussing it. So there was no secret that coronaviruses were perceived by the community to be a, do we want to call it a high risk or do we want to call it a big opportunity? It's somewhere at the intersection of those two or both, depending on which side of the dual use you stand on. When they went through that particular Event 201 planning series, which, by the way, there was in Germany a analogous planning war game for a pox virus, monkeypox specifically, that predicted almost to the day the Canary Islands outbreak. So another, as Bannon likes to say, there are no coincidences. You know, so another odd intersection of planning and time happened then. But in this case, one way to think about this, and it's not necessarily a definitive way. I mean, I don't know the answer to this outstanding question. All I have is more questions and hypotheses. But one way to think about Event 201 is that when you bring together people that are already in the narrative, they're coming from the likes of CNN, which obviously profits from these types of things. They profit from spreading fear among the public of a variety of different, you know, it's the classic, to trivialize it, the common phrase with the press, if it bleeds, it leads. And this is like bloodletting on a massive scale. What's not to like if you're CNN or the Washington Post or the New York Times is great for subscriptions and clicks and views. So you bring together people that are already deeply embedded in this sector, particularly people from the intelligence community, Department of Defense, NIH, Public Health Service, and you get them to game out a set of scenarios about how to respond to this hypothetical of a highly pathogenic coronavirus. Another strange coincidence is the case fatality rate used in Event 201 planning was precisely the case fatality rate that came out of Neil Ferguson and the Imperial College in that clearly, you know, disgraced quote modeling that they did. Another odd coincidence. But you feed these guys, this type of people, a scenario like that, and then you ask them to play out a response pathway, and it's no surprise that you end up with basically an autocratic totalitarian response that's very heavy-handed and relies on military intelligence, censorship, etc. And then whether intentional or not, they all of these stakeholders have just gone through this Event 201 planning session, or their buddies have. They're well aware of the outcomes from that. And now they're confronted starting January 4th. I'm sorry, anything else is bullshit. Because I got a call from Michael Callahan on January 4th saying I need to be alert and concerned about this novel coronavirus. Callahan being one of the CIA's top people in biodefense and, by the way, gain of function research. And so this whole talk that the government didn't know until mid-January, Tony didn't know, and blah, 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 it's all bullshit. Okay. That's just covering. But, you know, whatever, at whatever point they were triggered with the information, and really the if you discount the war games spread scenario and just go with the, you know, increasingly dominant and well-supported scenario that this emerged into the Chinese population in something like the third week in December, our government knew about it almost immediately. Certainly our intelligence community did.
And we had to take, oh, go ahead.
And they reached for the playbook that they had worked up during Event 201, and they deployed it. And they deployed it across the entire Five Eyes community in the most harmonized campaign, propaganda campaign, and influencer campaign the world has ever seen. I mean, it's stunning. I had the privilege of traveling quite a bit in Europe, and the same things, the same messaging, the same strategies were deployed across the Western world in a harmonized fashion. There is only one agency that can do this
Okay. There are no other organizations that have the organizational skill and agility to do this other than the CIA and Five Eyes Alliance. There's no one else that has the capability to do it. You can talk about WEF until you're blue in the face. WEF does not have this kind of operational capability.
There truly is a deep state, if you will. We're talking with Dr. Robert Malone, the original inventor of the mRNA vaccine and author of Lies My Government Told Me and the Better Future Coming. We'll be right back after these messages. Stay tuned.
Sometimes a car comes along that changes everything, with innovations never thought possible and features that make you wonder, how did people survive without this? This is that time, and this is that car. This is the world's first VW. Equipped with transparent doors to eliminate reasonable suspicion, whatever that means. A 10-2 steering wheel that keeps hands visible at all times. We remove the glove box so there's no confusion about what the driver is reaching for. With a touch of a button, the ultrasonic biometric scanner displays the license and registration of the driver to ensure contactless exchange of information. With no trunk, nothing can be concealed, so therefore, there is nothing to search and seize. To ensure you will never be mistaken for breaking the speed limit, we've installed limited edition airless tires. And we removed the engine because, honestly, why risk it? DWB, the first vehicle of its kind, where the safety feature is the car itself.